Osho, The Dhammapada, The Way of the Buddha, Volume 5, Discourse Number 9.
Bhagwan, do not live in the world in distraction and false dreams, outside the law. Arise and watch. Follow the way joyfully through this world and beyond. Follow the way of virtue. Follow the way joyfully through this world and on beyond. For consider the world a bubble, a mirage. See the world as it is, and death shall overlook you. Come, consider the world, a painted chariot for kings, a trap for fools. But he who sees goes free. As the moon slips from behind a cloud and shines, so the master comes out from behind his ignorance and shines. This world is in darkness. How few have eyes to see. How few the birds who escape the net and fly to heaven. Swans rise and fly towards the sun. What magic! So do the pure conquer the armies of illusion and rise and fly. If you scoff at heaven and violate the law, if your words are lies, where will your mischief end? The fool laughs at generosity. The miser cannot enter heaven. But the master finds joy in giving, and happiness is his reward. And more, for greater than all the joys of heaven and earth, greater still than domination over all the worlds, is the joy of reaching the stream.
The first sutra. Do not live in the world in distraction and false dreams outside the law. It is one of the most misinterpreted sutras of Buddha. For centuries, the Buddhists have believed that Buddha is saying, renounce the world. That Buddha is against the world. That he is a life denier. That he would like everybody to become an escapist. But that is not the meaning of the sutra. The sutra has a totally different meaning. The sutra says, do not live in the world in distraction and false dreams outside the law. It does not say, do not live in the world. It says, live in the world, but do not live in distraction and false dreams. Live in the world, but do not live outside the eternal law of life and existence. Live in the world, but be not of it. Live in the world, but do not let the world live in you. If it was understood the way I understand it, the whole history of Buddhism would have been totally different. And not only the history of Buddhism, but the whole face of humanity would have been totally different. Because the sutra was understood as against the world, the Buddhists became life negative. They became more interested in dying than in living. They became more interested in suicide, slow suicide, gradual suicide. Suicide became their goal. This is a perversion. Perversion of a great master and his great words. The words are clear. Do not live in the world in distraction and false dreams outside the law. Live in the world without distraction, without dreams, and in communion with the law. His expression is a little negative. His expression is always a little negative for a certain reason. Rather than saying in an affirmative way, Buddha always says the same thing in a negative way. The reason is that when you affirm something, it becomes so definite, so solid, that people would tend to follow it blindly. Hence, Buddha uses the negative expression. That way he gives you freedom to analyze, to meditate, to find out on your own. He never says what is. He always says what is not. He defines through the negative. It is a beautiful device for those who can understand. But for those who cannot understand, it is a dangerous device. Because they will become victims of negativity. And Buddha had to choose the negative way of expression. Because for centuries before him, religion was always talked in affirmative way. And the affirmative way had become a burden on people's being. He changed the whole religious expression. He will not say God is. He will only say you become absolutely empty and then see what is. This is just indicating a way, very vaguely, so you cannot cling to it. Otherwise people are clingers. They will fall upon anything. And they will possess it. Buddha is elusive. You cannot catch hold of him. He says, be empty and see. He says, let there be no mind. And then see. He never defines exactly what will happen when there is no mind. He knows that if he says, what will happen if there is no mind, you will start desiring it. And to desire it is never to achieve it. Because desiring is a process of the mind. For example, if Buddha says, Just like the Upanishads say that when there is no mind, there will be great bliss. Now listening this, a great desire for bliss is bound to arise. But desire is mind. Even the desire for bliss. If just like the Upanishads, Buddha says, if you drop the mind, you will find God. Freedom. Absolute freedom. Immediately, the desire enters from the back door. How to find this eternity, this deathlessness, this joy, this God? How to attain to paradise? Now it will be impossible to drop the mind. The mind has taken a new form, a new desire, new garments. But it is the same old mind. First it was desiring money, power, prestige. Now it desires God, samadhi, enlightenment, bliss, truth, freedom. The objects have changed, but the mind is not in the objects. The mind is in the process of desiring. Hence Buddha never gives you any object to desire. He takes away all the objects. This can be done only via negativa. And he leaves you into an emptiness. But that emptiness is not real emptiness. Just the contrary. It is fullness. It is plenitude. It is overflowing with bliss, with God, with love. But Buddha will never say that. About that he is very conscious. Because for centuries the affirmative has been the distraction for people. Millions of people in the East have become desirous of the other world, the other soul. So much so that the very desire for the other soul became their hindrance. To destroy that hindrance, to remove that obstacle, Buddha uses the negative way. But man is such a fool. The masters move very cautiously. They take every step very cautiously. Because man is such a fool. They take every precaution not to use any word even which can be misinterpreted. But all words can be misinterpreted. Man is so unconscious that to expect that he will understand rightly is to expect too much from him. He is bound to misunderstand. In unconsciousness, misunderstanding is the only possibility. The Upanishads were right, but they were misunderstood because of their affirmative approach. People became very indulgent. If life is God, then indulge in God as much as possible. This is a logical conclusion. If existence is God, then eat, drink, and be merry. If to be is to be divine, then enjoy life then let your life be a merry-go-round. All is divine. The Upanishad says, Sarvam Khalvidam Brahm. All is God. If all is God, then why not accumulate as much money as you can? Because money is God. You see how our unconscious mind goes on distorting. If all is God, then why not have more power, more prestige? Then why not go on great ego trips? If all is God, then ego too is God. The Upanishads say, Aham Brahmasmi, I am God. And when it is heard into deep unconsciousness, we understand the Upanishads are saying the ego is God. Because to us, I and ego are synonymous. The Upanishads are misunderstood because of their affirmation, their total affirmation. And Buddha is misunderstood because of his negation, total negation. He moves the pendulum to the other extreme. Just to avoid the pitfalls that he had seen on the path of affirmation, he moved to the other extreme. He used only negative expressions. Do not live in the world in distraction and false dreams outside the law. He could have said in a more positive way, live in the world without distractions, without dreams. Live in the world in accordance with the ultimate law. Es dhammo sanantano. Live in accordance with the eternal law. But that is not his choice. He had seen the affirmative becoming an imprisonment. And it was a necessity to destroy the affirmative. You can destroy the affirmative and for the time being, while the master is alive, people will understand his negative because he is there to explain it to you. But when he is gone, then the negative becomes your imprisonment. Hindu sannyasins are caught in the affirmative and Buddhist bhikkhus are caught in the negative. My effort here is to help you understand both and to understand your capacity to misunderstand. And be very alert. Otherwise, each word is going to create something else that was never meant. A performing octopus could play the piano, the zither, and the piccolo. His trainer wanted him to add the bagpipe to his accomplishments. So he placed the Scottish instrument in the octopus room. Hours passed, but no bagpipe music was heard. The trainer was disturbed. The next morning he anxiously asked the 8-tentacled creature, "Have you learned to play that thing yet?" "Play it," replied the octopus. "I have been trying to lay it all night." But the octopus can be forgiven. You cannot be forgiven. But men behave in the same way. As unconsciously as possible. Even if they become conscious sometimes, their consciousness is also mixed with unconsciousness. Even if they are alert, their alertness is not pure. Even if they are watchful, their watchfulness has something wrong in it. McBride and Kavanaugh were in a cafeteria sitting near the "Watch your hat and overcoat" sign. McBride kept turning every minute, nearly choking on his foot, to look at his overcoat. Kavanaugh continued eating, paying no attention to his own coat on the hook. But McBride's constant twisting began to irritate him. "You dope," he said. "Stop watching our overcoats." "I'm just watching mine," said McBride. "Yours have been gone for half an hour." Man's state is that of a mess, of chaos. Great work is needed to make you really alert. And the first sutra is the beginning of that great work. Do not live in the world in distraction and false dreams. Your mind is continuously creating distractions. Just watch your mind and you will understand what Buddha is saying. It never allows you to sit silently even for a few moments. If you sit silently, it says, why not listen to the radio? The newspaper must have come. Your post may have arrived. Why not go to the movie? Why not see the TV? If you are in the shop, the mind says, go home, rest, you are tired. If you are at home, the mind says, what you are doing here, wasting your time, go to the shop. You could have earned something. The mind never allows you where you are. It never allows you to see things as they are. It is always taking you somewhere else, either in the past or in the future. It never allows you to be in the present. Either it drags you into the memories, which are nothing but footprints on the sands of time. Or it drags you into the future, great projections, great expectations, desires, goals. And you become so much involved with them as if they have any reality. And the reality is slipping out of your hands. Meanwhile, you are engaged in all these trips into the past, into the future. The mind never allows you and will never allow you to see that which is. It always takes you to that which is not. Edith was complaining to her friend Rose that her husband never showed any interest in making love. He would just sit every night and watch television. Rose suggested that she make herself more appealing and somehow tantalize him. So the next night, Edith put on her most bewitching perfume and dressed herself in nothing but shoes, hat, gloves and handbag. She went into the living room and casually strolled around. He kept his eyes glued on the TV set. She coughed and he finally looked up at her. Are you going out? He asked. Of course, she said sarcastically. Great, he replied, because I was hoping you could mail this letter for me. He is not there. He is not seeing the woman. He is not seeing that she is naked. He is not there at all. Nobody is. Everybody is somewhere else. It is said by the ancient Sufis that God wants to meet you. But wherever He thinks you should be, He comes there, but He never finds you there. You are always somewhere else. He comes in the present, you are in the past, you are in the future. He knows only one time, now, and only one place, here. But you are never here, and you are never now. You are always there, and you are always then. The meeting is impossible. He knows no other time than the present, and no other place than this. He lives in thisness, suchness. Buddha's word is tathata. He lives in suchness, tathata. Buddha's, one of the names is Tathagat, one who lives in suchness, one who has become free from all the distractions of the mind. And the miracle is that the mind consists only of distractions. So once you are free of all distractions, there is no mind left. In the present, there is no mind. In the present, there is only consciousness, awareness, watchfulness. Live in the world, but not through the mind. Don't let the past or the future stand between you and the reality. And if you can manage, even for a few moments, the state of no mind, that's what meditation is all about. You will be surprised that suddenly you are in rhythm with existence. You will know what Buddha calls Es Dhammo Sanantano, the eternal law. You will pulsate with it, vibrate with it. You will be just a wave in the great ocean of the law. You will be in such attunement, in such at-one-ment, in such deep harmony and akash, that the whole sky will start showering flowers on you. The whole existence will rejoice with you. This is paradise. Paradise is the state of no mind. Buddha calls it the lotus paradise, because your consciousness opens up like a lotus in the early morning sun. And there is great fragrance, great beauty. And there is great grace. But remember, he does not mean, as all the commentators down the ages have said, that renounce the world. He is saying renounce the mind. Mind is the world. Renounce distractions and renounce dreams. Because if you live in dreams, you cannot see the reality. Your eyes are covered with the dust of dreams, layer upon layer. There are dreams and dreams and dreams. And you are surrounded by so many dreams, you cannot see what reality is. And your priests go on helping you to create new dreams. Your psychologists go on helping you to create new dreams. If they take away one dream, they immediately replace it by another. That is the whole foundation of the science of hypnosis. That man can be persuaded to believe into something absolutely false. Hypnosis shows the capacity of man into falling in such dreams, in such unrealities, which look on the surface unbelievable. Have you seen any hypnotist perform? If he says to a person that you are not a man but a dog, the man believes. If he has been hypnotized rightly, if he has been hypnotized into deep sleep, hypnosis means created sleep, deliberately created sleep. If he has been hypnotized rightly and told that he is not a man but a dog, he starts barking like a dog. He may have never done it before, but he can do it immediately. He believes it. And the moment you believe it, you become it. Of course, your belief is false and your becoming is false. Psychologists are becoming aware that almost 90% of diseases are only beliefs. My own understanding is that as they will go deeper into it, they will find almost 99% diseases are beliefs. Maybe for the first time it was a real disease, but then you started believing in it. You started projecting it. You started repeating it, rehearsing it, practicing it. And slowly, slowly, it became a reality for you. Go sometime into an insane asylum and see people. They are the same people like you, just a little ahead of you. The difference is only of degrees. You may be below the boiling point, maybe 99 degrees. And they may have gone beyond 101 degrees. Just a 2-degree difference or 1-degree difference. The insane people go on living in their own world. They create their own world. They believe in their own world. They believe so much that you cannot pull them out of their dreams. Their dreams have become realities. That is their insanity. I have heard about one man. Who became mad and he started thinking that he has gone dead. Now the whole psychological department of that mental institute was after him to pull him out of the idea that he is dead. It was a challenge for them. It was something new also. They had never come across such a case. They tried everything. But it was impossible. Because mad people may be mad, but they are as much logical as you are. They have their own logic, their own rationality. They have a great capacity to rationalize everything that they are doing. Finally, a great psychologist was called from the outside to help. The great psychologist came, he talked to the man, and he asked him a single question. He said, "Do you believe that dead men can bleed?" He says, "No, never. How can dead men bleed? Once one is dead, it is impossible for a corpse to bleed." Then he says, "Come along with me." He took him to the mirror. He pricked his hand with a sharp instrument. Blood started coming out. He said, "Look, so this proves that you are still alive." The madman laughed and he said, "This only proves that my statement was wrong. Dead men do bleed." It becomes so impossible to pull them out. And the same is the case with you. As far as Buddhas are concerned, the same is the case with you. To pull outside your minds, to help you to climb out of your dreams, it is really difficult. Hypnosis tries one method, but that is not the method of the Buddhas. It gives you another dream, maybe a better one, a little more sophisticated, little less dangerous, less harmful, more beneficial, but a dream is still a dream. Whether you dream of poison or of nectar does not really make much difference. At least it makes no difference to the man who has become awakened. Ordinarily it will make a difference. A man who believes that he is drinking poison will always remain ill. The man who thinks that he is drinking nectar will always look healthy, joyful. Yes, in the ordinary way there is a difference. Hence, hypnosis has a limited utility. If you cannot be pulled out of your dreams, at least you can be helped to move from nightmares to sweet dreams. That's the function of hypnosis. After being troubled with recurring headaches, for which her doctor could not find the cause, Jean decided to consult a hypnotist. Amazingly enough, after two treatments, the headaches disappeared. Her husband Ben was intrigued and asked how the cure had been effected. Jean said, "Well, all I had to do was to put my hand over my forehead and repeat several times, "I have no headache, I have no headache." Some months later, Ben was aware that he was losing interest in the physical side of marriage and decided to consult the same hypnotist for help. He did so, and the result was amazing. Jean was ecstatic and asked how it had been accomplished, but Ben refused to tell her. Finally, one night, Jean noticed that Ben was staying in the bathroom for an inordinate length of time before coming to bed. She tiptoed to the bathroom door and peeped through the keyhole. He had one hand over his forehead and his lips were moving. Putting her ear to the keyhole, she heard him murmuring, "She is not my wife. She is not my wife." Now this is creating a new conditioning. You are getting from one prison into another. Maybe a better prison with more facilities. But a prison is a prison after all. And the Buddhas want you to be free of all prisons. Do not live in the world in distraction and false dreams outside the law. Arise and watch. Follow the way joyfully through this world and beyond. You can see that how Buddha has been misunderstood. You will not find Buddhist bhikkhus joyful, not at all. Very sad, somber. Living almost hopelessly in despair. They can't find anything to be joyful about. Because from the very beginning, they have gone on a wrong track. Buddha says, arise and watch. How to get out of the mind and its distractions and dreams? Arise and watch. Wake up and watch. Watch your mind. What it goes on doing to you. How it plays games with you. How it goes on and on creating new illusions for you. New hopes for you. Buddha is not saying become hopeless. He is not saying fall into despair. Because that is again a mind strategy. The despair, the anguish, the anxiety. The escape is again a mind game. You are worldly, the mind says, there is nothing in the world. Listen to the Buddhas. Escape from the world, go to the Himalayan caves. And everything will be perfectly right. In this world, nothing can ever be right. Now the mind is giving you a new projection, a new project. Buddha says, don't follow the mind. Detach yourself from the mind. See the mind separate from yourself, playing around, creating new games, alluring ones, enchanting ones, in which you can be caught again. Follow the way joyfully. And if you are really following the awakened ones, you will follow joyfully. Because the man without distractions and dreams is naturally joyful. Not that he has something to be joyful about. Not that he has attained great money, power, prestige, or the power to do miracles, the power to walk on water and cure the blind people and help the dead to be alive again. No, he has no reason to be joyful. But just because all the distractions of the mind have disappeared, the energy involved in the distractions is released. That energy is joy. William Blake is right. He says, energy is delight. William Blake has many beautiful insights. He is one of the greatest poets the West has produced. Just few steps more, and he would have been an enlightened person. These two poets, Walt Whitman and William Blake, they could have been Rishis, seers. Just few steps. Maybe only one step, a little jump. But they had come very close to the boundary of realization. William Blake says, energy is delight. He is right. This is a great revelation. It can't be said without experiencing it somehow, in howsoever a small measure. Your joy is always caused from the outside. You have won a lottery and you are joyful. You have purchased a house you have been longing for many years and you are happy. You have found the woman that you had desired and you are happy. But these are momentary happinesses. After 2-3 days the house will be old, and after a few days the woman will look ordinary. How long one can remain interested in a woman or in a man? Because these are superficial attractions. Sooner or later, the reality will be revealed. The Nazi leader Göring was seated next to a fine blonde Aryan Fräulein at a very important state dinner. During dessert, he began feeling her leg under the table. As his hand moved up her thigh, he heard a hoarse masculine whisper, "Don't be surprised when you get to my balls. I am secret agent X7. What things appear from the outside is one thing. What you will find inside is totally different. You may have fallen in love with a secret agent. Everybody is in for a surprise. When you fall in love with a woman, she is a totally different kind of person. When you are married to her, to your surprise, she is no more the same person. Sometimes you suspect what has happened. Has she deceived you? But she is also in the same situation. She is worried where that beautiful man has disappeared. There are old stories of frogs becoming beautiful princes. In my own experience, this just the opposite happens. Beautiful princes you bring home, and overnight in the morning you find there is a frog. Princes disappear and become frogs. All princes, unconditionally. Those stories have some truth in them. If frogs can become princes, why not vice versa? And nobody has ever seen any frog becoming a prince. And everybody has seen many princes becoming frogs. Arise and watch. The essential core of Buddha's message is awareness, mindfulness. Look at your own mind. Don't get involved with it. Remain unidentified. That's what he means when he says watch. And as you watch, you will become more and more awake. And your life will start having a new kind of joy, which has nothing to do with the outside. It wells up within your being. Follow the way joyfully. If you are rightly following the way of the awakened ones, Jesus, Buddha, Mahavira, Muhammad, it does not make any difference. Then one sure sign is that you will be joyful for no reason at all. You will be just joyful, naturally. If that thing is missing, remember, you have misunderstood. You have gone onto some wrong track. You have misinterpreted. Follow the way joyfully through this world and beyond. And look at the Buddhist bhikkhus. Miserable they are. I have known many. I have known the very famous ones. Miserable. There is no dance in their feet and no song in their heart. They are deserts. Nothing grows in their being. Nothing is green in their life. I have never come across a Buddhist monk. Who has flowers in his heart. Lotuses blooming, birds singing, nothing of the sort, just an empty desertness. And the reason is, Buddha's negative expression has become his way of life. He has become caught with negativity. How can you be joyous? Joy does not fit with his interpretation of Buddha. And the words are so clear. But you read only that which you want to read. And you see only that which you want to see. You don't read, you don't see that which goes against your prejudices. Such clear words. And yet, great misunderstanding has arisen. Buddhist monks are the most sad people in the world. Long faces. It is bound to happen because they have become escapists. And Buddha says, follow the way joyfully through this world and beyond. He does not forget this world. He says, through this world. If he was in favor of renouncing the world, then what is the point of saying through this world? He is not saying that renounce the world. Renounce the mind. And the world is renounced. You live in the world and yet you remain untouched by it. And a great joy arises in you. A great laughter. A great love. And you will be able to carry this love, this joy, this dance to the other source. Because it is something that is happening inside you, is not dependent on outside causes. It is not caused by anything. Remember, one of the fundamentals of life is that which depends on outside causes will be taken away from you sooner or later. At least one thing is absolutely certain, that in death you will not be able to carry it with yourself. But that which is independent of outside causes, that which is caused in the innermost core of your being, in your own interiority, nobody can take it away. It cannot be robbed. It cannot be stolen. Even death cannot destroy it. The body will be destroyed, but not the song. The body will be gone, but not the dance. The dance, the song, the joy will move into the universal song, into the universal joy, into the universal ocean of consciousness, of truth, of godliness. Follow the way of virtue. Follow the way joyfully, he repeats again, because he wants to emphasize he must be alert that his way of expressing things negatively can create a great misunderstanding. People can become sad, and the moment you are sad, you have fallen out of tune with existence. Follow the way of virtue. And what is the way of virtue for Buddha? He does not give any details. He does not give you 10 commandments. He gives you the 11th commandment. And the 11th is enough. If you fulfill the 11th, then you can forget all about the 10. Because in following that one, the 11th, all the 10 are contained. That 11th commandment is meditation. Meditate. That is what is missing in the Jewish Christian 10 commandments. Nothing is said about meditation. Everything else is included in, which are consequences, not the causes. The cause is missing. Virtue without meditation is an imposition. a forced imposition. Virtue without meditation is repressive. Virtue without meditation is pseudo. Virtue without meditation is just a facade. You can deceive others, but how can you deceive yourself? With meditation, there arises a totally different kind of virtue, a natural virtue, a spontaneous virtue. Whenever Buddha says, follow the way of virtue, he means meditate, arise, awake, watch. These are his words for meditation. Because if you are alert, you cannot do anything that is wrong. Not that you will have to prevent yourself from doing it. If you are alert, even if you want to do it, you cannot do it. Sin becomes impossible if you are alert. Then the virtue is the only possibility. Then whatsoever you do is virtuous. Out of meditation, the flowers of virtue arise, bloom. Their fragrance is released to the winds, into the infinity of existence. Buddha gives you only one commandment. Awareness. You can call it meditation, you can call it watchfulness, you can call it. His own word is sammasati. Right awareness. He insists each time he mentions awareness that it should be of right kind. Because he knows there is a possibility of a wrong kind of awareness too. What is wrong awareness? People can be aware of others' acts, of others' faults, can be very keenly aware. In fact, they are. It is so easy to see everybody else's fault in the world. That is the wrong kind of awareness. That is not your business at all. Who are you and why you should be worried? Right awareness is awareness of one's own being in its totality. All that is good and all that is bad. But as you become aware, the bad starts disappearing. Just as when you bring light into the room, the darkness disappears. When the light is in the room, darkness cannot exist there. Sin is darkness, forgetfulness, unconsciousness. For consider the world a bubble, a mirage. See the world as it is, and death shall overlook you. One thing which is unique to Buddha is he never says believe. He never says what I am saying, you have simply to follow it. No. That is not his approach. He is very much against believing. He invites you for consideration. He says, for consider the world a bubble, a mirage. He says, not because I am saying it is a bubble, a mirage, that you have to believe. You consider yourself. If it is a truth, Your consideration will show it to you. What is the point? What is the need of believing? Religious priests go on telling to people, believe there is God. Believe there is paradise. Believe that your good acts will be rewarded and your bad acts will be punished. That there is heaven and hell. Believe. No priest ever says, consider. No priest ever wants you to be independent. Only a Buddha, an awakened one, can say to you, consider, because he respects you. He knows you are deeply asleep, but your sleep is full of the potential of waking up. Today you are asleep, tomorrow you may be awake. Today you are not a Buddha, tomorrow you will be a Buddha. Your potential is there. You can go on neglecting it for lives together, but one day or other, it is going to happen. A Buddha has tremendous respect for people. Hence, he can never say believe. Belief means the person who is saying has no respect for you. He does not trust your intelligence enough. Buddha trusts your intelligence. He provokes it. He challenges it. He invites you. It is an invitation. Consider the world, a bubble, a marriage. He says, I considered and I found it only a bubble, a marriage. A deception. An illusion. I have lived in the illusion, believing that it is true. You are also living in the illusion, believing that it is true. But consider, give it a little more time. See a little more intensely, concentratedly. Try to penetrate its secret and you will be surprised. Just a pinprick and the bubble is gone. Just a little more alertness and there is no marriage. It disappears. Gurdjieff, one of the Buddhas of this century, used to give a certain meditation to his disciples, which is very significant. He used to say to his disciples that if you can remember in a dream that this is a dream, then you are on the very threshold of transformation. But it is very difficult to remember in a dream that it is a dream. When you are in a dream, you believe that this is truth. And every night you are in dream. And every morning you come back and you see and you know that it was all false. And again, when you fall asleep, the dream is there and you start believing in it again, as if you never learn anything. But how to remember? He had created a small device to few advanced disciples. He will give this advice and this device, that in the daytime, because you cannot do anything while you are asleep and in dream, the preparation has to be done in the daytime. Then you have a little bit of awareness. He used to tell them that as many times as you can do. Brushing your teeth in the morning, just put your left hand on your head and say that this is all dream. Walking on the street, put your left hand again on the head and say this is all dream. Let your left hand and its putting on the head become associated with the idea that this is all dream. Repeated many times, whenever you will put your left hand on the head, immediately the idea will come, this is all dream. Or whenever you will say this is all dream, automatically your left hand will go on the head. This has to be practiced at least for 3 to 9 months in the daytime. And then Gurdjieff used to say, one day suddenly in dream, you will see it happen. There is dream and you put your hand on your head, your left hand, and suddenly you say, this is all dream. And the moment you say it, the dream disappears. You are fully awake. The dream cannot exist if you know that it is dream. And that's a great experience when it happens. You can try it. When it really happens, that one night your hand goes to the head while you are asleep, while you are dreaming, and suddenly the idea that this is all dream, and you are all awake immediately, and you find your hand on the head, it has become so associated. It is like a conditioned reflex. But one thing has become clear, that if you can remember this is dream, the dream disappears. Only the dream can disappear by your remembrance that this is a dream. Reality cannot disappear. You can go on remembering this is a dream, but you know all the time this is not so. Philosophically, you can go on repeating this is a dream. And you can be very cunning philosophically. Once it happens, a great philosopher came to the court of the king. He said, this whole world is a dream. The king was a crazy type of person. He said, then wait. He had a mad elephant. He told his whole court to watch. The mad elephant was brought into the courtyard of the palace, and the poor philosopher was left alone with the mad elephant. The mad elephant started chasing, and the poor philosopher started crying, save me! He will kill me, save me! He was crying and weeping. And the mad elephant took him, threw him away, at least 30 feet away. He fell on the ground, so many bones fractured, crying and weeping, and then he was brought back to the court, and the king said, what now? What do you say about the elephant? Is that too a dream, maya, illusion? But philosophers are cunning people. He said, yes. It was a dream, a bad dream, a nightmare. And the king said, what about the fractures? He said, that too is a dream. Then why you were crying? He said, I was crying in dream. And I was crying and shouting, I remember perfectly well, that saved me. But it was all dream. Now this is cunningness. But man can find cunning rationalizations for everything. The philosopher knows it is not a dream. The elephant was far too real. And he was shaken, afraid, and death was so close by. He had forgotten all his philosophy. But back again into the safe court, and the mad elephant gone, although he is fractured all over, it is painful. Again his philosophy is back, his ego is back. Reality is reality. You cannot make it disappear by remembering that it is a dream. But if something is a dream, just by remembering that it is a dream, it disappears. Buddha says, for consider the world. What world? Does he mean the rocks and the mountains and the rivers and the stars? No, not at all. He means the world that you have been creating in your mind. Your mind world is a bubble, a mirage. See the world as it is, and death shall overlook you. If you can see the truth as it is, without your mind coming in between, you will not die. Death will be impotent in encountering you. Death will come, but it can't take anything away from you. Because you have already dropped all those dreams which death can destroy. Death can destroy only the mind. Consider it. Death cannot destroy your body. Death cannot destroy your soul. Death can only destroy the mind. The mind is a mirage. But the man who has dropped his mind himself voluntarily, nothing is left for death to destroy. Come, consider the world, a painted chariot for kings, a trap for fools. Buddha calls those people kings who have intelligence, understanding. He does not call a person king who has much money, a great kingdom. No. Buddha calls a man king, an emperor, who has conquered himself, who has conquered his foolishness, his unconsciousness, who has been able to dissipate all illusions. He is the real king. He has entered into the kingdom of God. Again invites, come, consider the world, a painted chariot for the kings. As far as kings are concerned, the knowers are concerned, the wise ones are concerned, it is just a painted chariot. It is not a real chariot. It is just a painting. But a painting can be done so beautifully. The painting can be three-dimensional. And it can give you all the appearance as if it is real. But a painting is a painting. It is not real. It is real as a painting. But it is not the chariot. It cannot take you anywhere. You cannot ride on it. The world is a painted chariot for kings. and a trap for fools. It is because of our unintelligence, unawareness, that we become trapped in it. The 70-year-old groom and the 25-year-old bride cast raised eyebrows when they checked in at a hotel. Next morning, he came down eagerly into the dining room and ordered ham and eggs. From his smile and twinkling eyes, it was obvious that he was extremely happy. After a while, the bride came down. Her face was drawn, voice weak, complexion pale. She ordered toast and coffee. The waitress said, "Honey, I don't understand a young bride looking worn out with an old man for a husband." "He double-crossed me," replied the young bride. "He told me he had saved up for 60 years, and I thought he was talking about money." Beware of your mind. It can give you great illusions. It can make things appear as they are not. And it can help to see things as they are not. The mind is very inventive. The mind has only one power, that of dreaming. In the daytime it dreams. Then it dreams through words, language. And in the night it dreams, then it dreams in pictures. And there are two types of people. Few people dream in black and white. And few people dream in technicolor. The people who dream in technicolor can become poets, painters, sculptors. They can be very artistic. They need not have to depend on drugs. Their minds supply mescaline and LSD. Their body chemistry is enough to create psychedelic trips for them. But there are other people who only dream in black and white. Those people are the scientists, businessmen, bankers, calculative people, mathematicians. But whether you dream in black and white or in colors, it does not matter. A dream is a dream. Beware of the dreams and watch your dreams day in, day out. Because they are continuously there. You can watch them. And by watching them, you will become unidentified with them. You will become a mirror reflecting them. And this brings great freedom. Freedom from dreams is freedom from the world. Come, consider the world a painted chariot for kings, a trap for fools. It is the same world. For the meditators, for the kings, It is a painted chariot. Buddha is not saying anything against the world, simply describing its truth. And for the fools, it is a trap. It depends on you. They had been married that afternoon in Minneapolis and journeyed to the distant city of St. Paul, where they had a room at a downtown hotel. Night had fallen and the bride had already donned the beautiful silken nightie reserved for this occasion and was lounging voluptuously upon the bed. For over an hour now, the groom, still fully dressed, had been gazing out the open window into the darkness. Impatiently, Gladys addressed him, "Why don't you undress, dear, and come to bed?" "Never mind me," he replied. "Go ahead and go to sleep. My mother told me this would be the most wonderful night I would ever see, and I don't want to miss a single minute of it." Now, how you are going to interpret the Buddhas in the world of your unconsciousness? Everything is distorted. You impose your ideas. You color. You distort. You manage to believe in whatsoever you want to believe. Otherwise, it is a simple fact, if you look at the world, if you look at yourself, if you look at people, if you look at your life, your past, it will not be very difficult to find that 99% of it is just dreaming. Only 1% is true. And because of this 99% dreaming, you are not able to find that 1%. And only that 1% is substantial. All else is shadow. That 1% is truth. All else is untruth. That 1% can save you, can become the boat to the other shore. As the moon slips from behind a cloud and shines, so the master comes out from behind his ignorance and shines. What is ignorance in Buddha's idea? Not the lake of information, but the lake of attentiveness. This sutra also has created great trouble, because the Buddhist bhikkhu thinks that to come out of ignorance he has to become very knowledgeable. So he ponders over the scriptures for years. He goes on repeating scriptures upon scriptures. And there are many scriptures. In fact, Buddhism is the richest religion in that sense. Buddhism has near about 60,000 scriptures. Christianity is very poor, just the Bible. Mohammedanism is very poor, just the Quran. Buddhism has so many scriptures. The that one can go on wasting many lives pondering over them. And yet, that is not Buddha's meaning. When he says, the master comes out from behind his ignorance and signs, he is saying, it is not a question of gaining more information. It is a question of becoming more conscious, more alert, more attentive. But these people, the pundits, the scholars, they can always find reasons, proofs, arguments to support themselves. All their arguments are stupid. Once I was staying with a Buddhist monk. He was reading Lankavatara Sutra, one of the very famous Buddhist scriptures. I asked him how long he has been reading it. He said, for 20 years, this has been my everyday practice. I cannot live without it. This is my food, my nourishment. This is my soul. I asked him, but you don't seem yet to have become a Buddha. I don't see any light in your eyes, any silence around you. I can't smell any fragrance. 20 years you have been trying to dispel ignorance by knowledge. And Lankavatara Sutra is a beautiful scripture. But it is like a painted lamp. You can go on worshipping the painted lamp for 20 years or 20 centuries. It is not going to dispel darkness. A real lamp is needed. One has to become conscious inside. But he started arguing, giving so many reasons. His first argument was this, which is absurd to all outsiders, but this is how it happens. The insiders think this is a great argument. He had two disciples with him, they said, right. This is a beautiful argument. The first sutra says that those who will read this sutra are bound to become liberated. He said, look, the sutra itself says that those who will read this sutra are bound to become liberated. I said, this is foolish. It is like I have heard Mullah Nasruddin one day declared into the marketplace that my wife is the most beautiful woman in the world. People gathered. They knew his woman, his wife, perfectly well. She was an ordinary, homely woman. And here he is declaring that she is the most beautiful woman of the world. They said, Mullah, who has given you this information? He said, who else? My wife herself. Just the last night she told me. Now, quoting the sutra itself in its favor, scholars are cunning people. In Indian scriptures, this is always done. First, they will praise the book so much so that if you read it once, you will be liberated. Even a single word of it heard is enough for liberation. Now they are persuading your greed, seducing your greed. They will relate old stories that one man who heard this sutra at his deathbed went directly to heaven. Another who was ill heard this sutra, became healthy. Another who was poor heard this sutra, became rich. This sutra is so precious that it gives in this world and the other both. Every sutra, every scripture starts this way. This is nothing but salesmanship and rationalization. The husband wired home that he had been able to wind up his business trip a day early and would be home on Thursday. When he walked into his apartment, however, he found his wife in bed with another man. Furious, he picked up his bag and stormed out. He met his mother-in-law on the street, told her what had happened, and announced that he was filing suit for divorce in the morning. Give my daughter a chance to explain before you take any action, the older woman pleaded. Reluctantly, he agreed. An hour later, his mother-in-law phoned the husband at his club. I knew my daughter would have an explanation, she said, with a note of triumph in her voice. She did not receive your telegram. The mind is very cunning. Unless you are really watchful, you are bound to be trapped by it. This world is in darkness. How few have eyes to see. How few the birds who escape the net and fly to heaven. Very rare. It is very rare to find a man who has eyes to see, and very rare a man who has got back his wings and can fly to the ultimate. This world is in darkness, and the darkness is created by our unconsciousness. It is not part of the world. It is projected by us. How few have eyes to see. It is really very rare. Hence in the old days people used to travel far and wide to seek somebody who has eyes. They will knock on many doors before they will come upon the right door. They will listen to many teachers before they will find a master. And once they used to find a master, that was the end of their journey. Then they will become involved, committed. Then they will devote their whole life and their whole energy into the work. Again, something like it is happening in the world. People have started looking for masters. And when you look for masters, remember, out of 199 will be false. And the false will appeal you more than the real one. Because the false will speak your language. And the false will try to convince you, argue. The false will quote scriptures. The false will console you. They will try to convince you. They will give you beliefs. And the real is going to be harsh. Many people knocked on George Gurdjieff's door and escaped from the man because he seemed to be so cruel. He was immensely compassionate. But because of his compassion, he had to be hard. Otherwise, people cannot be awakened. When you want to wake up a man, you don't go and sing a lullaby by his side. You have to shake him. You have to throw ice cold water into his eyes. And of course, it looks cruel. He may be having sweet dreams. And you are throwing cold water into his eyes. A real master is harsh. A real master is always watching for the right moment when to hit you, when to hammer you. And he is trying to find the weakest point in you so that you can be exposed easily, exposed to yourself. Because if you are not alert of your own weaknesses, of your own limitations, you cannot grow. A real master gives you growth, gives you wings, but takes away many things. All the rocks hanging around your neck, he takes them away. Although you think they are diamonds, great diamonds. He takes your chains away, although you think they are your securities. He takes all your conceptions, beliefs away, and you think those beliefs and conceptions are great knowledge. You have been bragging about them. He takes many things away from you which you have always cherished and thought are great treasures. He looks harsh. And he gives you something of which you have no taste up to now. He gives you something very unknown and takes all that is known to you. He looks cruel. Many people come to me. Very few courageous ones are going to stay with me. The cowards will escape. They will find many rationalizations. One coward yesterday wrote a letter to me. I will not tell you his name because he is a new one and it is not right to hit him so hard, so immediately. He wrote a long letter. That you talk about freedom, that you talk about love, that you talk about how to get rid of churches, beliefs, rituals. I want to become a sannyasi, but I don't want to wear orange because this is a ritual and this is again a bondage. This is again fettering me. This is again a change. He does not know what it is. Because one can know it only by entering into sannyas. No outsider can know what it is. And no insider can explain it to the outsider. It is not explainable. No lover can explain about love to somebody who has never loved. No man who has eyes can explain to the blind man what light is. What really he is trying is protecting his ego, but he is not aware of that. Sannyas is dropping your ego. Yes, by dropping your ego you become free. Freedom means egolessness. And the orange clothes and the mala and meditation, he says, these are the three fetters you are giving to your sannyasins. These are not fetters. These are just indications from the sannyasin that he is ready to take the plunge into the unknown. A simple gesture that he belongs to me. A simple gesture that now if I want to do something to him, he is ready. Orange has no other meaning. It is just an statement from your side that you are even ready to look crazy for me. That's all. It is a love affair. And if you are not even capable of looking crazy for me, then it will be difficult. Because later on, more and more surrenders will be needed. And ultimately, when you will drop your mind, it will look like insanity. In the beginning, it looks like insanity. Ultimately, it proves to be the only sanity in the world. But that is only later on, when the mind is dropped. Now the mala around your neck with my picture. It makes you look silly. It is not a fetter. It is simply your readiness. You say, okay. If you say this has to be done, I am ready to do this. And if you think even meditation is a chain, a prison, then why you want to become a sannyasin at all? And the man seems to be very clever in his foolishness. A long letter, and he concludes the letter that if whatsoever I say is right, you need not answer. If what I say is wrong, then too, there is no need to answer. Then why write it to me? Why waste my time? Reading the whole letter, if it is right, please don't write to me. If it is wrong, what is the need to write it to me? If you know already that you are right, there is no need to be here. And if you know that you are wrong, then take a jump. Then seek and search for that which is right. Yes, I am all for freedom. But I don't mean by freedom what you mean. You mean freedom of your ego, and I mean freedom from the ego. That's how things go continuously distorted. Swans rise and fly toward the sun. What magic! So do the pure conquer the armies of illusion and rise and fly. Be ready. Kabir's statement is worth remembering. He says, Hansa Ulchal Vades. O great swan, let us fly to our real land. The swan is a symbol in the East of purity because it is so white. And the swan is also the symbol of purity because it lives in the deepest mountains in the Himalayas. It drinks the purest of water. There is a lake in the Himalayas, Mansarovar. It must be the most pure water in the world because the air is absolutely unpolluted. Rarely a man reaches there. Very rarely, once in few years' time, a man reaches. The journey is long, arduous, dangerous. Swans live on that lake. Only when it is too cold and the lake becomes frozen, they come to the plains. Otherwise, they remain there. That is their original land. Once the winter is gone, they start flying back to the Himalayas. The swan is a symbol that this world is not our home. This muddy pool of water is not our real home. We belong to some other world, the world of Himalayas, of virgin peaks, of purest of lakes. We belong to Mansarovar. Don't forget. Don't become too much involved in the muddy water of this pool. Remember, go on remembering your real home. Buddha also uses the same symbol. Swan, rise and fly toward the sun. What magic! So do the pure conquer the armies of illusion and rise and fly. If you scoff at heaven and violate the law, if your words are lies, where will your mischief end? Beware of yourself. The fool laughs at generosity. The miser cannot enter heaven. But the master finds joy in giving, and happiness is his reward. Don't be a miser. Share your love. Share your joy. Share your dance. This is the way of my sannyasin. And this is what Buddha wanted, but his followers never followed him. And more, far greater than all the joys of heaven and of earth, greater still than dominion over all the worlds, is the joy of reaching the stream. That is the Buddhist expression, reaching the stream. Buddha says, coming to a master is reaching the stream. Getting involved with the master is entering the stream. And once you have entered the stream, you can relax. You can go with the stream. The stream is already going to the ocean. Be part of a master. and your journey, real journey, has started. Now you are on the way towards the ultimate ocean, the ocean of joy, of peace, of silence, of truth. What other religions call God, Buddha calls Nirvana, the ocean of enlightenment. Enough for today.